Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with attorney Jessica Gonzalez for a discussion on hate speech in the American media and actions to document such hate speech. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Is Comcast favoring its own digital phone service over others? The Federal Communications Commission is investigating the nation's largest cable provider for degrading the sound quality of competing internet phone services while leaving the company's own digital voice service unaffected. Free Press and Public Knowledge filed a letter with the FCC back in October asking the agency to investigate. Last week, the FCC sent a letter to Comcast asking for clarification of its practices concerning so-called Voice over Internet Protocol, or VoIP, services. Free Press counsel Chris Riley explains.
The FCC found a distinction between telecommunications service, which was available to offer raw transit, and an information service, which offered transit in conjunction with some other features. And so what the FCC is doing in this letter is it's looking into that distinction.
Telecommunications services are subject to different rules than information services.
It's really about the payment systems that underlie the phone networks. This is an incredibly rich and complex system of laws and regulations. The public isn't as aware of just how much money gets shuffled around in the background among all of these phone companies for the phone calls and the internet traffic that's being made. And companies who offer information services are, by and large, not required to pay into this system.
That money, called intercarrier compensation obligations, goes to support rural phone providers and a number of other high-cost portions of the telephone network. By separating out their VoIP service, Comcast has essentially become a phone service, a categorization Comcast has worked hard to avoid. The company now has a choice: to treat their voice service as a true voice over IP service and not favor their own system over any other, or to be a phone service and operate under telecommunications rules.
The clearest benefit here to consumers is in the promotion and protection of competition of VoIP services. We don't want to see Comcast giving a secret competitive advantage to its own VoIP service product over competing VoIP service products like Vonage and Skype. And I think that the biggest repercussion of this, customers will see a more level and more fair playing field, and will see more investment into competing VoIP products like Vonage and Skype, and will have better choices and better quality products.
In December, the bloggers at Progress Illinois found their YouTube account suspended. The reason? They had posted video clips from local Fox affiliate WFLD. Progress Illinois, an online news and commentary website, had posted short excerpts from three broadcasts. The posts used the video clips to support their commentary and credited Fox Chicago as the source for the footage. One of the posts even commended the Fox affiliate for its reporting. Fox complained that this was a violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, and demanded that YouTube take down the videos. YouTube responded by suspending Progress Illinois' account, taking with it more than 100 videos compiled by the organization, including more than 25 originals. Paul Levy, an attorney for Public Citizen, which is representing Progress Illinois in the dispute, explains that Fox's actions are an abuse of fair use and have far-reaching implications.
Progress Illinois made what would seem to be some pretty straightforward fair use excerpting from news programs, and the result of having multiple claims of infringement filed at YouTube was that their entire YouTube account was shut down to the extent that bloggers depend on access to posting facilities such as YouTube. The threat of having them taken down based on spurious claims of fair use has the potential for suppressing useful and entirely protected speech online.
While laws like the DMCA were established to protect intellectual property, there are provisions that protect the use of copyrighted material for certain purposes.
Taking of a small portion, using them in a transformative manner for purposes of commentary, using it for the purposes of non-commercial speech as opposed to strictly commercial activity. There are simply a series of factors, and applying those factors, we think it's clear that the using of small excerpts from long interviews was fair use.
Some say it's not YouTube's policies, but the DMCA itself that needs revising.
DMCA provides for automatic takedowns based on the mere assertion that there's infringing activity going on. It's our view that incidents like this illustrate the problem with allowing automatic takedown.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
Homeowners facing foreclosure should know that their plight is not an immediate priority for Barack Obama. The new president last week told Illinois Senator Dick Durbin that the White House doesn't want its economic stimulus package to include a measure that would allow judges to adjust the mortgage payments of bankrupt homeowners. It's called bankruptcy cram-down legislation, and it was the only ray of hope in sight for at least some of the millions facing loss of their homes. Obama previously claimed to support the concept, but backed off in fear that cram-down might endanger his economic stimulus package. As a consolation, the White House assured Senator Durbin that cram-down will move to the pile of must-pass legislation to be acted on at some later time. I have a feeling this is going to be the pattern under President Obama. His genius for rhetoric allows him to cast a large and glittering net with which he hauls in loads of people who are willing to support him. But at some point, the question arises, who will Obama support wholeheartedly? The answer, I suspect, is that Obama is much quicker on the take than on the give. Obama got everything organized labor had to give during the campaign. What the unions want most desperately in return is passage of the Employee Free Choice Act, which would make it much easier for workers to join unions. Obama promised to back the union measure, but now it's been moved to the back burner, just like the besieged homeowners' cram-down bill. It's rumored that Obama Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel wants to delay action on the Employee Free Choice Act until after the midterm elections in 2010, after which, presumably, there will be fewer Republicans around to oppose it. Of course, there might just as easily be more of them. Obama seems easily intimidated by rich people and their Republican servants. Obama will dismiss an ally to his left in a second, but he's quick to back off even a hint of confrontation with the rich and powerful. There weren't supposed to be so many tax breaks for the not very needy in Obama's stimulus package, but Obama included them as goodwill gifts to the Republicans, hundreds of billions of dollars worth, offered in the hope that the GOP will be kind to the rest of the stimulus package. Remember, the battle on Capitol Hill has not begun, yet Obama relentlessly gives ground to the GOP while help for unions and desperate homeowners is delayed indefinitely. The Republicans will soon figure out, if they haven't already, that Obama would much rather displease his own people than fight the right. He is so quick to jump over the aisle to the Republican side, sometimes it seems like he likes it better over there. Obama has been holding meetings with Republicans only on Capitol Hill lately. It appears they're getting next to him. Speaker Nancy Pelosi insists that the Democrats will move to repeal George Bush's tax cuts for the rich, but President Obama has gone silent on the issue. homeowners that hoped the Congress and president would give them a chance to plead their case with a bankruptcy judge are running out of time. They need Barack Obama's help right now, but he's got other fish to fry. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. We now feature an interview with attorney Jessica Gonzalez for a discussion on hate speech and the American media and actions to document such hate speech. The following interview was recorded on Saturday, January 31st, 2009. We are joined on the phone with Jessica Gonzalez. Jessica Gonzalez is an attorney with the Institute for Public Representation at Georgetown Law School in Washington, D.C., who is representing the NHMC, the National Hispanic Media Coalition. And we have Jessica on the phone joining us from Washington, D.C. Jessica, thank you very much and welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
Yes. You, in one particular action you're representing the NHMC on, has to do with hate speech. And it has to do also with a particular study, the formal academic study about hate speech that's been recently organized. Could you begin by, tell us a little bit about the study and the legal action that's stemming from it.
Sure. Well, the study is being done by the UCLA Chicano Studies Research Center, two prominent social scientists, John Noriega and Javier Iribarren. And what the study is doing is developing a scientific methodology to quantify and evaluate hate speech. And they have released some preliminary findings just 2 days ago, and they should be releasing a full report sometime in the very near future.
Tell us a little bit more about that. What are they finding and what do they plan to release?
Sure. Well, what they're doing, they're in the process of reviewing 3 40-minute clips of either talk radio or cable news. In fact, they're reviewing Lou Dobbs, Michael Savage, and the John and Ken Show, which is broadcast in Los Angeles. And from those clips, they're drawing out the different types of hate speech that they're hearing. And so at this point, I think they've identified 4 types of hate speech. 1, false facts. 2, flawed argumentation. 3, divisive language. And 4, dehumanizing metaphors. And so this is just the first step in providing a mechanism by which other researchers or the government can really start to evaluate hate speech.
And you're also, you yourself are part of a legal action that's kind of using this study as ammunition of a sort. Tell us a little bit more about this legal action.
Sure. Well, on January 28th, we filed a petition for inquiry at the Federal Communications Commission asking the FCC to look into the nature and extent of hate speech in our media, its effects, and to also look into options for countervailing or reducing the negative effects of hate speech. We also, simultaneous with the filing at the FCC, filed a letter at the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the NTIA, and what that letter is asking is for the NTIA to update a report that it issued back in 1993 called The Role of Telecommunications in Hate Crimes.
What was that report about?
Well, the answer is really in the question. It was truly dealing with the role of telecommunications in hate crimes and trying to dissect whether or not there is a correlation between speech that occurs in the media and the crimes that were occurring back then in 1993. However, the National Hispanic Media Coalition feels that the study is really long outdated. Not only has media grown in an immense fashion since 1993, talk radio, internet, etc., cable news, the amount of hate speech has increased quite drastically, and not to mention the amount of hate crimes. For instance, in just the past 4 years, there's been a 40% spike and hate crimes targeting Latinos. So we really feel that there's no way that this study can reflect what's going on in our society 15 years later. So that's really the reason that we're asking for the NTIA to update that report. And in fact, last time the NTIA looked at this issue, it did so in conjunction with the FCC and the Department of Justice, and so it was a collaborative effort to really look into this very serious issue.
Let's discuss hate speech some. I suppose we could begin with a definition of the term. What does it mean for speech that that I would say, or that anyone else might say, to be classified as hate speech?
Well, we've gone with the definition that was released back in 1993 in the NTIA report, because that is the last time that the government has spoken on hate speech. And so that has sort of two definitions. One is speech that directly advocates violence, and the other one is speech that creates an atmosphere fear of prejudice or hate that may lead to violence.
And so that's basically the way in which this is harmful. If what you say incites someone to violence, that would then cause harm and therefore be classified as hate speech. Am I right there?
Right. Although I think we should be careful in when we talk about the harms of hate speech. Certainly the crimes are the most dramatic harms that result from hate speech, but I think that there's others. And for instance, we found studies that show that people who suffer from or who are the targets of hate speech suffer severe psychological harms, and in particular children, because they're more impressionable and not able to process what they hear in the media, what they see in the media.
You might hear some skeptics who might claim that you're kind of over-exaggerating this, that there's the famous childhood taunt, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names will never hurt me. And yet you see that there's this evidence here that it seems like names and words can actually have an impact on people's lives. When you hear that kind of response about seeing hate speech as as being dismissed, how do you respond back?
Well, you know, I have two responses. One is that this is why we're asking for the inquiry. This is the exact reason, so that we can really get some real data on whether or not there is a cause. We know anecdotally that as hate speech has gone up, hate crimes have risen dramatically. But the inquiry is really to establish that in a scientific way, and that's what we're looking to do right now. The second is, you don't have to go far to see examples of hate speech and to see examples of the crimes. And that's one thing that the petition really, really goes over in great detail. You know, there's people asking over the airwaves. For instance, in Montana, John Stokes said that if you don't speak English, you should have your hands chopped off. And then he says things like, the Bible says if they break into your country, chop off their leg. We have to forcibly get rid of these people. There's also neo-Nazi radio host Hal Turner has a website that goes into great detail about advocating use of extreme violence against Latino immigrants, and that we should get rid of these people with force, load up your guns, have plenty of ammunition, stake out where they're going to be next, and go there and do what has to be done. And so I think the examples really speak for themselves that this is a serious problem.
And one which no doubt would try to be addressed in this study, and this particular action would at least help to gather up information to help to try to present that forward. I could see another kind of playing devil's advocate again, another approach to trying to address or at least respond back to some of the charges that are raised both by this particular study and by the legal action accompanying it. And I could see that response back taking a kind of economic form. Talk radio is a popular medium in the United States, and probably upwards of 90 or 91% of all talk radio tends to skew towards the political right wing, and perhaps understandably so, that's what at least tends to be popular. So since that's not liable to change or may not change in any time soon, that you might hear, just deal with it. If you don't like it, just don't listen to it. How would you respond back to this line of inquiry?
I guess I have two responses. One is, by me merely not listening to it, that doesn't really solve the problem, because there are those crazies, those locos, who will listen to it and who will be inspired into action because of it. And so just by me or any other Latino not listening to what to the things said on the airwaves, that might take care of the direct psychological damage to me, although I think I would hear it secondhand from some other people in society. But I don't think it really resolves the issue of the fact that this, or at least we're quite certain that this leads to violence against Latinos, and that harm cannot be obliterated just by merely turning off the whatever you're listening to or watching. The second point is that I don't really think that the market is necessarily generating this type of programming. I looked quite extensively into radio formats and when I was doing the research for this petition. And one thing I found is, A, I don't think people really have a choice in talk radio. There's this pervasive amount of conservative talk radio and very little either objective or liberal talk radio. And there's a reason for that. The radio companies have found a format that works, that makes money by playing off this myth that the mainstream media is liberal. And so what they've done is created this medium that's decidedly conservative. And they really play into the divisive language that the UCLA study really talks about, creating this us versus them dynamic, so that those people who out there in society who feel that they're not being served by the quote-unquote liberal mainstream media, they turn to this talk radio where they create this us versus them dynamic, where there cannot be any sort of objective discussion about issues because it's us, you know, the righteous versus them, the enemy. And so I think that in a way, it's not really purely economics or a marketplace that's creating attention for these rock talk radio formats. I think it's really that they've dug into this gold mine of, we know that when we create this dynamic where this is your safe haven for conservative, you know, information, that really is what's creating the fact that there's 91% of radio, top radio formats are conservative. Not to mention, this is all exacerbated by the fact that very few people own the airwaves at this point in time. So I don't want to, you know, call anyone out, but there's just a few companies that own a whole lot of radio stations, and they syndicate these shows. And so so it's not that this is what the people want to hear in the localities. In fact, some of these shows, like for instance Michael Savage, is on several different stations in the San Francisco area. This is because it's cheap, because they only have to pay one host, and they can just syndicate this out to a bunch of different stations, that all of which they own. So I'm just not sure if that theory really pans out.
And certainly the factor with regards to media concentration has played into this role that you've sent out. Let me ask let me try to approach this study and this particular action from a kind of a devil's advocate, but looking at it from a kind of statist or government response. There is the response of the traditional First Amendment free speech argument that if you're objecting to what I have to say, you're violating my freedom of speech. But that doesn't necessarily apply to hate speech, which could be a factor with regards to hate crimes. How do you respond to people who give this kind of First Amendment free speech argument?
Well, listen, we are not asking for any sort of regulation here. We're not asking. We could have filed quite a few things at the FCC. We could have filed petitions to deny the licenses of those stations that are peddling hate speech. We could have filed a petition for rulemaking asking the FCC to create regulations. regulations to sort of block hate speech. That's not what we did. We filed a petition for inquiry to collect information, to collect data, so that we can have a really thorough and thoughtful discussion about what's going on in our media, and so that the people, the citizens, know what's going on in their media. If anything, I think this furthers First Amendment interests in having an informed public. Not to mention that it's long been held that it's the right of the viewers and the listeners to hear diverse viewpoints, not the broadcasters to say whatever they want, so which is paramount. So, I mean, I would say to those critics, you're just steps ahead of us here, because we are not asking for regulation. There's no possible way that the mere collection of information and data violates any First Amendment interest. And an agency is very sensitive to First Amendment freedoms and will be going forward with this.
And within the past year, that you've also heard this kind of resurrection of sorts of a fear among right-wing political interests and certainly right-wing talk show hosts of what's been referred to as the Fairness Doctrine, the FCC regulation that basically requires a breaking of tedium, you could call it, of viewpoints and information and perspectives of the public airwaves. And they could accuse this study and this particular action as maybe not necessarily advocating for the Fairness Doctrine, but a kind of Trojan horse that could someday perhaps lead to the restoration of the Fairness Doctrine. How would you respond to this line of inquiry?
I just want to be very clear. The National Hispanic Media Coalition is not asking for reinstatement of the Fairness Doctrine. We're not asking for any regulation at all. Right now, all we are asking for is for the government to collect information.
And to be able to make that available for people to see, hear, and read.
Right. By collecting that information, it will create a public record so that moving forward we can have really realistic discussions about what's going on based on concrete data instead of anecdotal evidence. Not to mention it will also afford the public an opportunity, should the FCC open a docket on hate speech, it will offer the public an outlet to voice what's going on in their local communities, so that this will allow the FCC or or whoever else might be working there with them, to determine whether or not licensees are serving the public interest.
Are you optimistic that the FCC, especially amidst the new FCC that's poised to take shape and a new Obama administration, that they'll that will appoint those new commissioners? You feel optimistic that the FCC will take this up?
I do. I feel very optimistic that they will take this up. I think this really goes along with Obama's promise of government transparency and openness and the decision making based on facts and information. And if anything, this could only facilitate that process.
What do you foresee as far as the future of this particular action goes? It would seem that you would call for, maybe a best case scenario might be as follows, that you call for, submit this petition for the FCC, calling for the FCC to open a docket to collect information. Information is then, well, hopefully the FCC will say, yes, we agree, let's do this. They then do this. Information is then gathered on a much more scientific basis, perhaps using the study that has been commissioned by the National Hispanic Media Coalition with regards to this. And then what?
Well, then I think we have to look at the data and information collected and see where we should go from there. At the very least, I think it should foster a really healthy and informed debate. But I'm just not able to say where I think it would go next from there without knowing what we're going to find. We would hope that it would sort of inspire the industry folks to come and work together. together with us on this, both NAB and the NCTA. We feel that most people and most broadcasters are really disgusted by the types of things that are said by sort of hate pundits, so to say.
Mm.
And so we think that at this point, if anything, we see some sort of cooperative endeavor.
You would figure that both the National Association of Broadcasters, representing the broadcast industry, and the National Cable Telecommunications Association, representing the cable companies and cable channels, would also find hate speech as odious as the NHMC and the Institute for Public Representation in Georgetown. Likewise, and so you would probably, the hope would be that you would be able to work with the government and with industry hand in hand to tackle this mutually agreed upon concern.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot speak for them, of course, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I would hope so, yes.
One last question. Clearly, you're very knowledgeable about these matters and have been working on them in a long time with regards to matters involving media, speech, policy, and economics. How did you get interested in this?
Well, I grew up wanting to be a news reporter, and so that's what I went to college to do. Somehow got off that train for a while, and a couple years after college went back to law school and rediscovered my love for what goes on in the media, and I'm just sort of a news junkie myself. I listen to all kinds of media, conservative, liberal, objective, what have you, newspapers, everything out there. I'm just a media consumer. And so that's what really draws me to this. And also, I think it's really important that the media plays a really important role in society. It's truly the fourth estate, in that it helps inform people so they can be good decision makers. And so I think what goes on in our media is really important, and I guess that's why I'm so interested in this.
We've been speaking with Jessica Gonzalez. She is an attorney with the Institute for Public Representation at Georgetown Law School in Washington, D.C., who is representing the NHMC, the National Hispanic Media Coalition, in an action before the Federal Communications Commission. And Jessica, thank you so much again.
Thank you for having me.
That was an interview with attorney Jessica Gonzalez, recorded on January 31st, 2009. The website of the National Hispanic Media Coalition is www.nhmc.org. The Institute for Public Representation is online at law.georgetown.edu/clinics/IPR. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.